Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 3rd, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two segments up tonight. First, in about 5 or 10 minutes, we'll be speaking with several unionists in North Carolina. The state municipal workers of North Carolina are allowed to join a union, but they can't do anything with that union. They're not allowed to bargain collectively. It's illegal for public workers to bargain collectively in North Carolina, as it is in the neighboring state of Virginia. We will talk to Ashaki Binta, who is an organizer with the United Electrical Workers Union, also the president of the local down there, Local 150, Raymond Saunders, Sanders. And then also a representative. They've gathered together a bunch of international observers who intend to bring a complaint against the United States for restrictions on the freedom to organize. And so they've got a bunch of international observers who've joined them, and we should be speaking to a representative of the Nigerian Labor Congress as well. That's in about 5 or 7 minutes or so. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded the other day with Leo Panitch, who is a professor of political science at York University in Toronto, and the co-editor of the annual volume, The Socialist Register, a great writer on issues of international political economy, particularly the aspects of the American empire. We'll talk to Leo about the structure of that empire and just how troubled it really is as a result of the Bush administration's various frolics abroad. And before we get to that, a couple of headlines and announcements. First of all, been asked by my colleagues Esther Kaplan and Marilyn Niemark to announce the benefit for their show, Beyond the Pale, celebrating 10 years of bringing radical Jewish politics and culture to the airwaves. They're going to be broadcasting live on Sunday, November 13th, but there's also you can go and see it live at the Center for Jewish History on West 16th, 15 West 16th in Manhattan. That's noon to 2 p.m. Sunday, November 13th, and there will be guests including writers Grace Paley, Roya Hakakian, and Tony Kushner, activist Yifat Suskind, Harper's writer Jeffrey Charlotte, poets Ruth Knopfo Setton and Melanie K. Kantrowitz, K/Kantrowitz. I never could figure out what that was about, but that's her name. And then some music by the Klezmatics, the Hip Hop Hoodios, and more, plus Beyond the Pale hosts Esther Kaplan and Marilyn Kleinberg Niemark. The event will be broadcast live here on WBAI, but if you want to go see it, you can also do that and support Beyond the Pale. And for further information, call 212-647-8966 or visit the website of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice at jfreg.org. A couple of the economic headlines before moving on. First of all, the Institute for Supply Management, the organization for purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations and presumably have a good feel for what the state of the corporation's business is like. ISM, the Institute for Supply Management, does a monthly survey of its members, one of those in the manufacturing industries and one of those in the service industries. And they release those every the early part of every month to cover the previous month. Very widely followed measure of what's going on in the manufacturing and service economies. And it's got the manufacturing one has a very long track record. The service one is only about 7 or 8 years old, but it does have a very good record of tracking various aspects of the manufacturing and service economies. The ISM Manufacturing Index was off just a little bit in October, but it's still substantially in positive territory, signifying an expanding manufacturing sector. This survey has been overstating the strength of the manufacturing economy, especially manufacturing employment. So when we get tomorrow's employment report, we'll see. But it's reporting modest growth in employment in the manufacturing employment. But it's reporting very, very high levels of prices for industrial goods. A lot of the chemicals industry in particular, anything petroleum related, very expensive. And this is going, I think, to energize those in the Federal Reserve who think the economy is just a little bit too strong and needs a further dose of higher interest rates. The Fed the other day raising interest rates for, I think, the 13th or 14th time in a row. They've been doing it just in quarter point increments, but now interest rates are getting considerably higher than they were for a long time. When that long time when the interest rates were kept very low in order to keep to revive the U.S. economy coming out of the bursting of the 1990s bubble. That period of accommodation is now long over, and the big question is how long will things continue? How long will they continue to tighten? And will the new Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, when he takes over at the end of January, continue the tightening course? Almost every new Federal Reserve chair in history has begun with tightening and then shortly thereafter faced some kind of economic or financial crisis. So if Bernanke follows that precedent, he will continue to tighten to show his manliness and resolve and then face some kind of consequences for that tightening, maybe perhaps later next year. The ISM non-manufacturing index up sharply, also showing an expanding service sector, but the employment component falling, showing only as a modestly expanding service employment. That combination of what looks like a relatively strong economy with relatively weak employment is great news for productivity and great news for profits. The Labor Department reporting this morning a very strong growth in productivity, the output per hour of labor in the third quarter of this year. Up 4.1%, very strong performance and stronger than most people were expecting. Like I say, the squeeze on labor has been great news for those of you who follow that mystifying indicator of productivity and also those who own corporations and manage them. It's been very good for profits, but not so great for the working class with stagnant wages and weak employment growth. And Finally, turning to the job market, this morning's tally of jobless claims, the measure of the number of people who lost their jobs last week and headed over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. That was off 8,000 last week, continuing its decline after the spike from Hurricane Katrina. It is now suggesting a pretty good job market. It's 323,000 initial claims for unemployment, which is a lot of people, but as these things go, a rather decent number. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, we will be getting the U.S. employment report, and there will still be some hurricane confusion from that, but I'm expecting a moderately good number, 150,000-160,000 range. Good, not great, which is what it's been for some time now. So while we wait to get the workers from North Carolina on the line, can we take a little musical break?
Yes,
let's take a little musical break with this from the Gang of Four. And that a little excerpt from the Gang of Four is To Hell with Poverty from their new album, Return the Gift, which is a reprise of 14 of their old classic songs from about 25 years ago. Somewhat different versions, although not radically different. A little bit of a strange project, reissuing your hits from 25 years ago, but still pretty good. The Gang of Four's Return the Gift. And then if you get the album, you can you get a secret code, and you can download some music videos if you are so inclined. And now we're joined online by Ashaki Binta, who is an organizer with the United Electrical Workers Union, Local 150 in North Carolina. Welcome to WBAI.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So let's get the background here. The state of North Carolina, one of two states in the country, the other being Virginia, that expressly prohibits workers, public sector workers, from collective bargaining. Could you talk to us about this strange law in North Carolina?
Yeah, this law was established on the books here in North Carolina in the 1950s, you know, kind of during the period of Jim Crow and that kind of thing here in the South. And it was expressly written to prevent workers in the public sector from being able to organize unions in this state. And as you know, North Carolina is ranks 50th of all 50 states with the percentage of workers who are in unions or able to join unions. So this law has a tremendous negative impact on conditions for working people throughout the state. So we're fighting to change this here in the state.
And do any of the workers actually belong to unions and they can't bargain, or are they just not even in unions?
No, and you have the right to join a union in the public sector. That's your constitutional right, you know, the right to assemble and those kind of things. So workers can form unions, and we have our local here in the state, and there are other unions, of course. But this law prohibits workers in public sector jobs at the state, county, and municipal level from having a signed collective bargaining agreement, you know, with their employer. So this is something that, you know, we feel, you know, it's a violation of, you know, basic, you know, workers' rights and trade union rights within this country, but it's also a violation of international law and international labor standards and human rights. So it's a major issue for us.
Tell us something about the kinds of workers you're working with.
Well, our local represents public sector workers at the state, county, and municipal levels around the state through the University of North Carolina University system. We're on about 16 campuses. And we represent workers in the Department of Health and Human Services, and also we represent workers in several cities in the state of North Carolina, Rocky Mount, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Charlotte. We have members across the state.
And what are the wages and working conditions like?
Well, there are a lot of problems that people have day to day. There are serious issues of race and sex discrimination that go on in the various jobs on a day to day basis, where you see the levels of discrimination and, you know, hostile work environments that are created. Sometimes different like hangman's nooses and hanging effigies symbolizing a lynching, and these kind of things are found often in different workplaces around the state, unfortunately. You have grievance procedures that are ineffective, that the grievance never ends, it's never settled in favor of the workers oftentimes. You have health and safety violations that go on. People are fired unjustly, sometimes they're abused, their supervisor abused. So there are a lot of problems that go on day by day. And, of course, the wages are low, and when you really dig into it and take a look at the circumstances, you'll see that it becomes primarily, African-American and Latino workers and women workers who are at the bottom of these pay scales throughout the state. So there's a lot of major problems that workers are facing.
And I understand you're the president of the local of 150 with you, Raymond Sanders?
Yes, Raymond Sanders is here with us.
Yeah. Could we talk to him for a bit?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to WBAI.
Yes.
So tell us, what is it like to try to organize a union in such a hostile environment? You're really fighting an uphill battle, aren't you?
Well, it's very frustrating, because what you have here is that most of your state workers is dealing with fear factor. So they are intimidated by administration from joining the union. So you have the group that's considered to be want to be part of versus not part of, because of job that they have to depend on survival and struggle. Even though at a low wage, this is all they have. So it builds around them a whole defense mechanism. Administrator understand it, so they use it.
Well, how do they give us some examples of the complaints?
Well, basically, I could give you one primary example that we had a member that was intimidated by the supervisor that told him that, you see what happened to a guy that was in the union. You don't see him in there, nor any other person in the shop is in the union. And right away, he dropped out of the union because of fear factor, again, of losing his job. And you have to understand with most of the state workers, they have to work other jobs to supplement their everyday living.
Well, most people, most people think of public sector work as maybe not a place to get rich, but pretty secure and reasonably comfortable labor. But that's not true in North Carolina.
Not at all.
Pretty low wages. What are the benefits like?
The benefits, I give you a good. You figure it out when I tell you that a single parent today have to pay $550 deductible. That's not family. That's a single parent. And therefore, you have single mothers today across the state are dropping out of that plan because they can't afford it, leaving their child in a position where not knowing when they're going to get sick and if they're able to take them to the doctor. This is the kind of benefit that the state has. If it's someone in your family passes, they don't have the bereavement time. You have to use your sick time. So, you know, you have the other vacation leave with built on hourly, bi-monthly, depending on the years you have within.
What's it like for, say, more professional workers with college degrees? Is it the same kinds of working conditions in the public sector in North Carolina, or is it really a multi-tier, very hierarchical system of sort of privilege and a lack of privilege?
Well, it's more privilege. It depends on their job titles because you're subject to some kind of scrutiny in whatever field unless you're in the top administrator.
And I'll answer that too, Raymond, that even workers in those professional positions, that have college education, if you're African-American or a woman, you're still facing, the glass ceiling or, levels of discrimination. You know, these things are documented by the state itself where sometimes they're, women aren't able to, proceed, quote unquote, up the ladder. You know, the vast majority of the higher paying jobs are white males and the vast majority of the lowest paying jobs are African American women. And the same thing with the African American males. Whether you have a degree or not, there are very few that are in top administrative positions around the state, So with that, whether you have a college education or not or a degree, there can still be, problems in the state. So
let me elaborate a little bit even more so with what Ashaki just got through saying. I'll give you a primary example that's going on today within the DHHS facilities. There's not one black director aboard. And even on the assistant level, I can't think of one. So there right there show you a problem that is very bad. And to give you even more percentage, the workforce of the state, I can really say is 80% or higher. And in the administrator level, the whites are more in control as the level of 75% to 80%.
When we think of civil service work, also we usually think of a whole lot of formal procedures that would prevent those kinds of discriminations and seniority rights and tests and things like that that do remove some discretion in which prejudices can operate. Is this not the case? Do managers have a lot of whimsical power they can exert over workers?
Well, I mean, of course they do, but, federal law, state law has to be implemented. And sometimes, for workers to have to go through the court systems or use ineffective systems, EEOC or any other of these agencies sometimes that are, have been weakened and weakened and weakened over the years, it's very difficult to get, a satisfactory resolvement a lot of times of, these basic violations that people suffer. When you got to try to you got a family to take care of, and you got to try to hire a lawyer and go through years of litigation in order to resolve and prove something, you know, it can be very difficult. So that's why we believe in, you know, people should always use the law on their behalf. But the question of organization for people is very important, and collective bargaining rights where you can, you know, establish signed collective bargaining agreements are extremely important, because otherwise workers have no rights in the workplace in this state and many other states throughout the South. This is an employment at will state, which simply means that, you know, you're employed if the employer wants to keep you, and if there's any reason whatsoever, imagining the most ridiculous reason on earth, that employer can get rid of you, and you really have no recourse and no rights, you know, to deal with it. So collective bargaining and organization unions are very, very important for people, whether they consider themselves professionals or whether they're, you know, from the working class and doing, you know, the hard, important labor that we do in the public sector around the state.
And even if the laws are out there, they in the public sector, they are there, but you have to understand that they have means to avoid those laws. To cover their own self, they can do basically maneuver to do about what they want to do.
That's the voice of Raymond Sanders, who is the president of United Electrical Workers Local 150, and also speaking with him is Shaki Binta, an organizer with UE Local 150 down in North Carolina. And I understand you've brought some international observers onto the scene to basically indict the United States government for violating international law and standards. So tell us about that.
Yes. Well, we're waging a campaign here for collective bargaining rights in North Carolina. And we've conducted a series of public hearings around the state over the last year to kind of draw out to public opinion, educate the public about the problems that workers are suffering due to the lack of collective bargaining. And we also have called upon an international organization of lawyers called the International Commission for Labor Rights to come in and take a look at the situation here in North Carolina to see if North Carolina and the United States are, in fact, in violation of international law and international labor standards by having a law on the books preventing public workers from being able to bargain collectively. The United States is a member of the ILO, which is the International Labor Organization, which is an agency of the UN, the United Nations. So, you know, they're obligated, you know, under the ILO to uphold certain basic labor standards. But in this situation here in North Carolina, that's not happening.
And do you have one of those internationals with you there?
Yes, we have Sister Yemisi Ilasanmi. She's from Nigeria. She's an attorney from Nigeria. And I'll let her talk for a few minutes about her experience.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello, Yemisi Ilasanmi.
Yeah, thank you, yes.
Thanks for joining us. Is this what you expected from the United States, the country that is very rich and lectures the rest of the world about freedom and individual rights, this kind of treatment of workers?
Yeah, no, this is not what I expected. In fact, I must say that I was really very shocked when I read the content of the law, that is Section 95 and 98, using such language like unions and trade union organizations cannot bargain with their employer. It is null and void and illegal. I mean, so those are languages you expect to hear from the military dictatorship, not from a civilized democratic nation like the United States. So I must say that I really was very shocked to find that something as archaic as this is in the States, you know, especially North Carolina law. I think it is a democratic disgrace.
So what do you hope to do about it?
Well, the United States is a member of the International Labor Organization, and the ILO has some basic fundamental principles concerning freedom of association and the right to bargain, which is in the number convention numbers 87 and 98 of the ILO conventions. Those are fundamental principles. They are fundamental conventions that members, even if you have not ratified those conventions, members are obliged to follow those principles. So, well, we find that the state of North Carolina is very much behind in upholding this principle. And apart from that, we find out that the United States does have a trade relationship with other states outside, and they are always quick to tell other countries to uphold democratic tendencies, to uphold trade, fair trade, and whatever. But it is a disgrace that back home they don't do the same thing they want other countries to do. We feel that this is very, very sad indeed.
It is very sad indeed. But of course, the United States is notorious for not obeying international laws and norms. So I really doubt the United States would observe any kind of ILO ruling. So is this just some effort to raise consciousness and embarrass the United States government? Or what's the intention here?
Yeah, we intend to raise consciousness. But one thing also is the United States should not hold itself as being above the international law. One thing is to have your own national laws. Another thing is to say you are part of the international community. The United States is not above the international law, no matter what. It shouldn't be. It is very undemocratic to even hold that image at all. So we feel that for the United States to really try to at least improve its image, it should try to observe some basic tenets of democracy. Give your workers the right to sit in the round table with you. What is this collective bargaining right we are talking about? It is the right not to hold your workers in contempt. Because, yeah, you're saying that you as an employer, fine, you are also the government, but you've got to separate your role as a government and a sovereign from your role as an employer. Your workers have a right to dignity of labor. When you treat them and say, no, you cannot sit in a round table discussion with us, you are saying they are beneath you. You are dehumanizing them. You are taking away their fundamental human right to be treated like citizens, right to be treated like workers. They have earned their pay. They have the right to determine their condition of service with you. So I think that the United States in this case is confusing its role as a sovereign body with its role as an employer. They are two different things. So I think that point has to be made clear. Your workers have rights, your workers have human rights, and the United States has the basic responsibility of upholding the tenets of international democracy when it comes to workers' rights also.
We have only about 30 seconds left, but is there anything our listeners can do to support your struggle?
Yes, the listeners can do a lot. One thing is to put pressure on the United States, the state of North Carolina, so that those workers' rights should be respected. Everybody in one way or the other is affected. You are served by public employees. They give their time. They give their human resources. They give their skill. They are selling their labor. There is a need for you to treat them with dignity. You have a right also. So in your workplace, if you can't negotiate with your employer, it is not a good thing. It's not a relationship of equals. So I think that there is a need for us all to rally together and let these workers have a voice. The voice is the voice of everybody. The listeners out there have a duty, a responsibility to treat workers with decency. One of the decencies is to give them the right to bargain. So I think that everybody, whether you're a public employee or not, we have a responsibility to humanity. That is to treat all workers with humanity, and I think it is our duty to do that.
And also, as the president of this local, to try to encourage all private and state workers to join this union to fight here so we can stop having oppressed people, so we can arise above this pettiness.
All right, well, thank you. We have to end it there. Thanks for all of you for joining us. I've been speaking. The last voice was that of Raymond Sanders, president of Local 150, the United Electrical Workers Union. Before him, we heard from Yemesi Ilisami from the Nigerian Labor Congress, and before that, Ashaki Binta, who is an organizer with Local 150 of UE. Let's take this little break, and then we'll be back with Leo Penich.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Okay, now let's listen to a little more Gang of Four before we get to Leo Penich.
Like a natural fight, but what We've all got opinions. Where do they come from?
Distant thunder from the east. Won't disturb the morning calm.
It seems like a natural fact.
And that an excerpt from Y Theory from the Gang of Four's new album, Return the Gift, in which they cover some of their hits from 25 years ago. But it's strange, but highly listenable. And now, someone who is not strange, but also highly listenable, Leo Panitch, professor of political science at York University and co-editor of the Socialist Register annual volume. Talked to him just the other day about the state of the American empire. So let's listen to Leo Panitch. I want to talk about the state of the American empire now, but just before we start, I want you to lay out a little bit of your understanding of how it works. It's not historically been a matter of Washington barking orders and everyone following. It's a little more complicated than that, isn't it?
They bark a lot of orders, but if people listen, it's not only because they bark orders. Well, I think it depends on different parts of the world, but certainly with the rest of the advanced capitalist world. For over 50 years now, there's been a degree of integration, penetration by American capital, very close linkages between the American state and the European and Japanese states, and a realization from the 1940s on that insofar as European and Japanese capitalists were going to have their capital protected in the Third World, it was going to be protected by the American state much more than by their own states. So there's been not only a complicity with American empire, but a active support for the American empire on the part of these foreign bourgeoisies, who also increasingly have, of course, been investing in the United States. And that's not only to accumulate in the United States, and it's most certainly not, in my view, to have their states challenge the United States by virtue of that investment in the United States. It's also to try to get the American state on their side. When Daimler bought Chrysler, it wasn't only to challenge the American domination of the auto industry. It was partly to be seen as an American corporation on the part of Daimler. And most of their propaganda around that, of course, is aimed at Congress to be seen as an American corporation, even though it was a takeover they presented as a partnership. Anyway, the point of all this is that it's not a matter of barking orders, it's a matter of the dominant classes in the other advanced capitalist countries seeing the American state and its imperial role and imperial garb and its management of global capitalism as part of what is necessary for their own interests.
So the model you're describing is not unlike, in some ways, the model of a successful capitalist domestic arrangement, in that the dominated classes give their loyalty because there's something in it for them.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we see the American state in this sense as responsible for not only American capitalism, not only for reproducing American capitalism, but take it at its word when it says that it is responsible for reproducing global capitalism. That's been something the American state, first of all in the context of the Cold War after 1945, always presented itself as doing.
But there have been considerable fissures exposed in this arrangement, especially the last several years with the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. Some people going so far as to pronounce the empire, if not dead, on the critical list. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I do think that the Iraqi adventure has overstretched American military capacity, and it certainly does indicate the rest of the world that they can't do this everywhere that they can't, through economic and financial bullying and IMF pressure, get countries to restructure themselves so that they play a role in reproducing global capitalism. Well, they can't get some states to do that without military intervention, especially those that have got money through oil, like Venezuela and Iraq. But any notion the neocons might have had that they would easily be able to do this in the rogue states, so-called, those they couldn't bring to heel financially or economically, Iraq proves that they simply can't do that. And I think that the tensions we've seen amongst the advanced capitalist elites around this are essentially about the elites in the other countries, and to some extent here in New York City, having seen that the Iraq adventure was likely to be a mess, or very soon after they went in recognizing that it was a mess. And the tensions were more about, is this a stupid strategy in imperial terms, rather than a fundamental breach with the empire. What they would like, the Germans and the French, what they would have liked would have been to the Americans have taken their advice more seriously, rather than to have dismissed it out of hand. So the tensions have been around that. And those tensions have always existed. I mean, especially the advanced capitalist states that are part of the American empire expect their voice to be heard in Washington. They expect their proposals to be heard, to be listened to, and they often think that they're giving sound advice. And I think they sometimes get frustrated that advice isn't taken in the economic arena. They were certainly very, very frustrated that it wasn't taken around Iraq. But there's no fundamental break. One just has to remember that every NATO country signed on to the Kosovo adventure in 1999. They all were very supportive, and still many are supportive in Afghanistan and Haiti. I've been very proud of the Liberal government in Canada, where I'm from, for not sending troops to Iraq and being somewhat critical. Nevertheless, they covered the Americans' backs by having battleships in the Gulf, by sending troops to Afghanistan, and, like the French, sending troops to Haiti. As the French defense minister said, we didn't like what the Americans did in going into Iraq, but they mustn't pull out now. If they did, we'd all be in a mess. So, no, it's not a fundamental break at all. It's a disagreement over military strategy in relation to Iraq, but it's not a fundamental breach.
And, of course, we see the French and the others cooperating with tightening the noose on Syria around in the U.N.
Yes, we do. And we saw the Germans and French at the U.N. endorsing the American occupation a year after they had voted in the Security Council against it going in. That endorsement is about to run out at the end of this year, and we'll have to see what they then do in terms of continuing American troops there, etc. But I think they're very likely to continue to endorse American troops there.
Today's Wall Street Journal has a piece on how President Bush's domestic political troubles may reduce his influence abroad. Do you think there's anything to that kind of thinking?
Yeah, I think they're probably rubbing their hands in glee at this. I think many Europeans would like to see a return to a more Clinton-esque type of foreign policy and economic strategy. I think a lot of them do feel, as I say, with a lot of the New York financial elite, that not enough attention has been paid to the Treasury's role in the empire, the American Treasury's role in the empire, that they have been too profligate in terms of the deficit, even though very few of these New York bankers are willing to give up their tax cuts. But I think many of them would, not only the Europeans, but even in the American ruling class, are not unhappy to see Bush in trouble. And I think there's been too ready an assumption on the part of the left that what Bush has represented and what the neocons represent is a permanent shift in the American ruling class. I'm not at all sure that that's true. This may be a hiatus from the Rubin, Volcker, Clinton type of political economic alliance. A hiatus to that coming back again after these two terms of neoconservatism under Bush.
You know, a lot of people, I'm thinking, for example, of David Harvey, make the argument that the Bush administration represents kind of an armed neoliberalism and draws a considerable, almost like a straight line between the two manifestations. You don't see things that way.
No, for a couple of reasons. One, there were many aspects of armed neoliberalism in the 1990s. I mentioned Kosovo. One has to remember that Iraq was being bombed and overflown all through the 1990s. And one could point to all kinds of other military coercive backups to the neoliberalism of the 1990s. So that's on the one side. On the other side, I think there is no question that the center of power in the Bush administration shifted from the U.S. Treasury to the Pentagon. I think that that is true. And I think that a lot of the far right who never got over the Vietnam War, who came back into office in lowlier positions in the Reagan administration, came to power and in very senior positions. I'm thinking of Cheney, Rumsfeld, and their ilk. In this administration, there's no doubt about that. I think the military hawks have been in the driver's seat. The question is whether that's a permanent shift. And I think the assumption that someone like David Harvey is making is that the contradictions of neoliberalism are so great, the economic weaknesses of American empire are so profound, that in order to be able to maintain capitalism at all, let alone neoliberal capitalism, there will have to be both domestically and internationally the visible arm, might of the state, facing down dissent around the world. I don't think that's necessarily true, partly because of the weakness of the dissent at home, above all, but also because even around the world we haven't seen any coherent, organized left opposition that is capable of displacing neoliberalism with something else. We've seen Islamic radicalism challenge American empire, but that doesn't amount to a coherent strategy for replacing neoliberalism.
Well, I'll recite the usual bill of particulars, and I want to hear your reaction to them. The argument for U.S. decline, I mean, aside from the political troubles that the Bush administration has led the empire into, but the economic decline is declining manufacturing base, huge current account deficit, enormous foreign debts, massive dependence on the Chinese central bank. I'm sure I could go on, but you got the flavor of it. What do you think of those things?
Let me preface this by saying that to say that the American empire is not economically weak is not to say, therefore, that it is good, that it is ethical, that we want it to continue. Its very strength seems to me to be the basis for wanting us to mobilize and a class resistance to it because of its very strength in being able to increase the rate of exploitation even right here in the heart of the empire. But I don't think it's weak, unfortunately, and I think we need to be very sober about what its strengths are. Number one, it's very commonly assumed that the decline of the old industrial center of American capitalism means that the heart of American capitalism is weak. Well, that tends to leave out the enormous strength of the United States in high-tech production. The United States in 1980 accounted for 32% of world production in those areas. In 2001, it still accounted for 32% of those areas, whereas German high-tech production declined, and Japanese by half, and Japanese declined by a third. The Chinese have gone up in those areas from 1% to 9%. And that's important, and it may indicate something in the future. But it does show you the continuing strength. And we're talking here about productive capital, after all, not even raising the question of finance, where America has remained so strong and so dominant, not all of which I think is speculation, some of which is indirectly productive in terms of the ability to move capital to some of those high-tech production areas.
And also an instrument of power and control.
And an enormous instrument of power, control, and management. And discipline, which does help produce the kind of increase in exploitation, precisely because of financial discipline over industry that has been so effective in the last 25 years and remains very effective today. With regard to the very large deficit, people tend to forget that amongst the G7, the United States exports have grown more than any other G7 country. The enormous deficit has to do with the enormous imports into the United States. And that reflects, again, the strength of the empire, not so much its weakness. It's the extent to which the American economy has been able to be the consumer engine for so much of global production. The Chinese miracle could not have happened without this. Walmart could not have happened without this. And insofar as it means that the Chinese end up holding American treasury bills, what this tends to show is that the United States is the only country in the world which can run a deficit of this size and not experience a shortfall in capital inflows, short-term as well as long-term, to cover them. The strength of the empire is also seen in the moves that the Chinese have made to gradually increase the value of their currency. And the fact that the American currency has declined, but declined in a relatively orderly and stable fashion, so that this year it's been rather strong after that decline, especially vis-a-vis the euro. So all of those, I think, are indications of both institutional and structural strength, economic structural strength of the empire. That's not to say that in order to cope with the size of the deficit, in order to manage the balance of payments, I mean the fiscal deficit, in order to manage the balance of payments deficit, there won't be increased exploitation in the United States. There will, and we see it now happening with pensions, and even again, amazingly, given how bad it's been here to begin with health care. There will be. But insofar as that doesn't produce a substantial revolt in the United States from the poor and the working class, then one of the things the American empire exports is the weakness of its working class.
Speaking with Leo Panitch, who is a professor of political science at York University in Toronto and co-editor of the annual volume, The Socialist Register. Shifting from that gloomy note, let's talk a little bit about resistance. There are some people who look at Chavez and other developments in Latin America and see the beginning of a serious resistance to neoliberalism. What do you think of that? How much heft is there to this?
Well, I think this is very promising, and I don't want to make light of the ideological importance of the hostility that so much of the world has to the Bush administration. And I don't want to make light of the fact that neoliberalism has not developed and cannot develop most of the third world. I don't want to make light of the significance of the Argentinian collapse, the country that most embraced neoliberalism, changed its institutions, you know, at the dictate of the IMF and the World Bank, and so on. All of this is very ideologically very significant, and I think it opens enormous spaces which the left needs to take advantage of. And in that context, the way that Chavez has taken advantage of this, the ideological gloss coming off neoliberalism and the ideological gloss coming off the American state, has been enormously impressive. And especially impressive in my view because he has increasingly attached the label socialism to his resistance, which reestablishes a ideological legitimacy for socialist experiments that the rest of the party left, the rest of the left that has had some state power, has been afraid to use, not just since the collapse of the Soviet Union, but been afraid to use really since the 1960s in any serious way. So Chavez is enormously important in this sense. The fact that it comes at the same time as the disappointments associated with the ANC in South Africa, with the PT and Lula in Brazil, is unfortunate. Nevertheless, those governments have constraints on them, if not in terms of adhering to neoliberalism as an economic strategy, they have constraints on them in terms of joining the Bush administration and attacking Chavez. That would be a traitorous act vis-a-vis their own base of a symbolic kind that they couldn't undertake. And they don't especially want to undertake, I think. And in that sense, there is room for Chavez and others who may follow his example in Latin America. There's going to be 7 elections in Latin America this year that may be of some import in this respect. He is striking an alliance with Castro of a kind that no leader since the Cuban Revolution has struck. He speaks of Castro in a positive vein in every one of his speeches. And the type of bartering arrangement that Venezuela and Cuba initiated, exchanging cheap oil for Cuban doctors, meaning that people in the barrios in Caracas were seeing medical help for the first time in their lives, is now being generalized. And generalized to regimes that aren't particularly progressive in Central America and the Caribbean on other grounds. And this is enormously important in terms of building really substantive alliances in Latin America. There's even, I think, milk being exchanged for Venezuelan oil with Argentina. This doesn't prevent a neoliberal domestic policy in Argentina, but it does, I think, begin to build the material base for a more substantive resistance to neoliberalism in American empire, with Chavez as a catalyst, and with the Americans not able, partly because of the overstretch in Iraq, but partly because of the support he gets from regimes that the Americans are doing deals with around neoliberalism. They can't, in that way, take on Chavez either. He has a room for maneuver that we haven't seen in a very, very long time, and this is very, very important. I'm not sure we see this anywhere else in the world. I don't think one ought to exaggerate what is happening at the moment in Central America, Latin America, Caribbean, and people then tend to assume that's happening all over the world. That I don't see.
There's a way in which anti-imperialism, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, becomes almost a form, just anti-Americanism. And the kind of structure you described at the outset, in which domestic ruling classes are deeply embedded in the American order, makes that much more complicated. So how do we think about anti-imperialism in which this nature of American power is so pervasive and so internalized in so many societies?
That's a very, very good point. And we, I think, may even see some anti-Americanism emerging from bourgeoisies in the Third World, and maybe even eventually in Europe, which will resist the purchase of, let's say, their financial sector by American investment houses. And this may even be presented in anti-American terms. We're not going to have the Americans take over our economy. They won't let us take over theirs, etc. But the degree of the integration on the part of the bourgeoisies in those countries is such that they may play the nationalist card, and even a bit of an anti-imperialist card, as they did in Bandung so many years ago, but continue to participate in the circuits of capital, in the institutional structures of neoliberalism, so that they won't do anything different in Thailand, let us say, than American banks would in Thailand in terms of linking the Thai economy into American empire and neoliberal capitalism. So I think your point is very, very important. It's very important that the left not enter into some ersatz form of, if I may say it, bourgeois nationalism that is going to look anti-imperial, but is not going to be, because national bourgeoisies in the old sense don't exist because of the degree of integration of the world's bourgeoisies into global capitalism and American empire. It's also very important that, and I think this is very likely now because of what I just said about the absence of national bourgeoisies, that the left realize that any effective strategy against globalization and imperialism today is going to have to entail quite a fundamental break, I think, with capitalism. That we're not likely to see the development of, outside of China, perhaps, national capitalisms that are capable of developing their economies. I'm really of the view that it's only some sort of socialism that is going to be capable of developing almost all of the economies in the Third World. And for that reason, again, I think we need a more socialist critique of globalization and American imperialism. And socialist critiques tend to be much less, or ought to be at least, much less anti-American. That is, they ought to be looking to the kinds of alliances that they can build with the American working class, the American left, the American poor, the American environmentalists, the elements of the American left that are involved in the anti-globalization movement, and not tarring with one brush Americanism.
And that was the voice of Leo Panitch, a professor of political science at York University in Toronto, and also the co-editor of the annual volume The Socialist Register, which should be out any week now, with a piece by me in it on the American business community. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening, and let's go out with a little bit more from the Gang of Four's self-cover album, Return the Gift, just out, 14 reprises of some of their classics from 25 years ago. This We Live as We Dream Alone. Till next week, bye.